We hear next Tom Wicker on prison reform. Mr. Wicker, the associate editor of the New York Times, was asked by the inmates at Attica State Correctional Facility to be part of the negotiating committee during the rebellion there in September of last year. Mr. Wicker's observations on the subject of penology are drawn largely from that experience. His observations, presented here this afternoon for the next hour, were delivered at the Sloan Lecture at Harvard in November 1971. This lecture was recorded and provided to WBAI by the Audiovisual Department of MIT. And now, Tom Wicker.
I want to preface everything I have to say tonight with the abject confession that I am classically on the question of prison reform or whatever one wants to refer to, correctional reform. I am classically an instant expert. Prior to the unfortunate events at Attica in September, my sole experience with prisons had been back in the late 40s and early 50s when I was this public information officer for the State Board of Public Welfare in North Carolina. We used to have a monthly magazine, and I used to have to go out once a month to the state prison and get it printed in the state prison shop out there, and I would do that in fear and trembling every month for fear that I would not reemerge. And so that isn't really a very deep background on prison matters. So when I went to Attica in September, quite involuntarily, I wasn't prepared for what happened up there. For instance, on Sunday afternoon before the ultimate armed attack on the prison revolt on Monday morning, a number of us in the so-called observers group went into the prison for the last time. There were eight of us, as I recall it. We went into the prison for the last time, and the purpose of this was to interview some of the hostages that they were holding there in order to convey to the outside world the fact that the hostages were not being harmed, which indeed they weren't being at that time. And so in the course of that, the prisoners brought up to me, they brought a prisoner, and they said, we want you to interview him in your accent and get his answers in his accent. He turned out to be a white fella from Conway, South Carolina, whose name was Bleece Montgomery. Conway, South Carolina happens to be about 40 miles, maybe 50 miles from the little town in North Carolina where I was brought up, across the line there. And Bleece Montgomery, I don't know whether he was named after the old Senator Cole Bleece or not. It is likely so. But anyway, he was a fellow who personified, in many ways, boys that I'd grown up with. He was about my age. People that I knew very well, I recognized him instantly, and after having gone through a pro forma thing on the microphone, I said to him, man, I said, what are you doing in Conway, South Carolina? What the hell are you doing in Attica? And he says, well, he says, you know how it is. He says, I couldn't make no money down south. And and he said, so I came up here, you know, and he says, I got to living with this girl, and he said, we weren't getting anywhere. He says, so we forced a check. And he said, I guess we didn't do so well. We were trying to cash the check, and said they caught us while we were trying to cash it. And they put us in the police car, and the policeman was taken to the police station. And while we were driving downtown, he said, the school's let out. And these little kids came running across the street, and they stopped the police car. And he said, the policeman who was driving the car got out and began chewing out the kids, you know, who were going across the street. And he said, man, I don't let nobody talk to kids like that. So he said, I put my head out the window, and I said to this cop, I said, man, don't talk to those children like that. And he said, so the guy came back to me, and he called me a name all of you would recognize. He said, he called me a name, and he pulled out his gun, and he hit me over the head. I said, he did. I'm standing there in the middle of the prison, you see, with all his prisoners. I said, he did. I said, what'd you do? Oh, he said, I got out of the car and cut his throat. And this is a very shocking story to me in my innocence about these things. And I said, well, God, I said, what happened? And he said, well, he didn't die. And he says, you know what? He said, I got 7 years. And he said, he got disciplinary action. And I'm telling you this story tonight not because I explicitly believe it, because I think in all these things you probably have to take 10% off the top for exaggeration. So, but I'm trying to give you a notion of the inverted viewpoint with which so many of these fellows who are in the prison today, white or black, tend to look at things. A viewpoint that we in our middle class comfort and in our affluence are unable to understand. This is a viewpoint that sees itself as the victim of a society which has many deficiencies, and those who somehow fall victim to those deficiencies are then penalized by society, become the scapegoats, become those who are put away. They become the forgotten men of society, and they're penalized for having been victims of conditions that they themselves had nothing to do with. As this fellow saw it, here was a policeman sworn to uphold the law, whose whole job was to uphold the law, who in the first place was abusing children, and who in the second place, when called to account for that, used violence to assert his authority. And when someone then responded to his violence with violence, the society gave Bleece Montgomery 7 years, and it gave that policeman, whose transgression, if we were to take that at literal face value, whose transgression was much greater since he sworn to uphold the law, they gave him disciplinary action. And we know what disciplinary action means. That means you're suspended for a week or two with or without pay, and then you're allowed to return to your job. And I'm trying to make the point here that when you look out at the world from the eyes of a prisoner in Attica or in Brushy Mountain or in Moundsville or Folsom or San Quentin or wherever it might happen to be, when you look out at the world with the eyes of a prisoner, you see a very different situation from what we see when we look at things from our middle class and undisturbed point of view. And this is why it may seem very strange that men who are convicted of murder, or men who are convicted of rape, or men who are convicted of purse snatching can confidently refer to themselves as political prisoners. And it's very difficult to say that a murderer is a political prisoner. He's not a political prisoner in the same sense that one hears the tap on the door at night in somewhere in Eastern Europe or in the Soviet Union, and the ultimate result is you're sent to Siberia for crimes against the state, if that still happens anymore. It's different from that. It's the fact that you are the outcast of society. You're the sacrificial goat. You're the scapegoat of society for conditions which you had nothing to do with creating, but which nonetheless result in a penalty for you. At another point during the prison revolt there, I got quite a lecture on the question of amnesty from a man named Philip Crowley, known as Brother Flip, who was one of the rhetorical, if not one of the authoritarian leaders of the revolt there, on the whole question of amnesty. He said to me, "You don't understand." He said, "You don't believe that we're entitled to amnesty, because you can't understand why prisoners who stage a revolt and seize the prison, why should we demand amnesty?" He said, I'll tell you why. He said, "I'm in here for armed robbery." And he said, "If you want to know the truth, I did it." And he said, "My lawyers tell me as these things go, I got a fair trial." All right, even Stephen, fair and square, as you know, we're quits on Saturday night. I did it, and I'm in here, even Stephen. "But what you don't understand," he says, "is that every day these people are committing crimes against me." He said, "I'm being abused physically, or I'm being deprived of the ordinary rights that any American citizen has, or I'm being cheated out of the money that I earn in the metal shop, or I'm being fed slop, or I'm being allowed to I'm either attacked sexually or I'm allowed to attack someone sexually. Every day in here, crimes are being committed against me." Now he says, "If in the course of crimes being committed against me, if the man who is committing the crime against me gets hurt or even gets killed, then," he says, "the question of amnesty for me is quite different from what it appears to you on the outside, is it not?" And I had to concede that it was, because if you look at yourself as those prisoners did, as being the victims of crime, and if you then see your resistance, which may have resulted in the injury or death to someone, as being resistance to the commission of crimes against you, then the whole question of amnesty becomes quite a different thing. And I think that it's this inverted point of view, inverted by our standards, that we get from prisoners today. It's this thing that we've got to try to understand. And it's this inverted point of view, this way of looking out at the world, that explains the increasing, the rising belief on the part of prisoners that they are indeed political prisoners, that they are the downtrodden, the forgotten class of society, and that they are the scapegoats of society. It explained this point of view. Why didn't, for instance, the prisoners at Attica accept, as reasonable men should have accepted, the so-called 28 points that our observer group was able to work out more or less there? We were the only negotiators in business at that point. We got a 28-point kind of deal. That makes a lot of sense. The New York Times has said editorially that this would have been a revolutionary advance in prison administration. Why didn't the prisoners accept that? Well, in the first place, there was nothing in there that was really substantive or of value on the single question that really mattered most, the question of amnesty, because a guard was dead by that time, and you had here the real question of whether or not someone might be prosecuted for murder. You had the real question here of sentences that were 2, 3, 4 years long, might be extended to 8, 9, 10 years long. You had really vital questions of what was going to happen to people absent an amnesty. So, without an amnesty point in there, you had the rest of the program was weakened substantially. Furthermore, of the 28, four of the points were concerned totally with ending the revolt, so that they had nothing to do with any kind of ongoing reform. There were a number of the other points, for instance, the guarantee for religious freedom, which had some meaning to the black Muslims in the prison, and for outside communication to members of families, and so you had a number of other points like those that all they did was to establish a bare minimum of human decency that the prisons ought to have been maintaining all along, everywhere. So they're not great gains, they're just simply nullifications of what previously had been medieval conditions. You had a number of other points, for instance, the promise of better educational systems in the prison that really are only cloudy generalities. It didn't mean anything. And finally, you had a number of other points, for instance, the promise to seek a minimum wage for all prisoners, points that had to go to the legislature or to other officials in a political climate that made it very doubtful whether you could ever get anywhere with that or not. So that those 28 points, so-called, which, as stated, in looking at it from our point of view, made a great deal of sense. Why didn't the prisoners accept a reasonable deal here, having revolted and having won all these points? Why didn't they accept that and make great gains? Actually, to them, they appear to be very few real gains in there. And anyway, and this is the point. Anyway, they didn't trust that. I was not able. They knew very well that I was not able to deliver anything to them. I wasn't able to guarantee the minimum wage. Commissioner Oswald or any number of state prison authorities wasn't able to guarantee any of those things. Their whole lives have led them to distrust that kind of promise. And the one way that document might have been taken seriously as an absolute pledge is if it had been voiced in some credible way on television. They had a television set in there and they could have seen it. If it had been voiced in some credible way by Governor Rockefeller. Interesting thing, the prisoners referred constantly to Rockefeller as the man. Now, he's the man. Because he was the man in the sense of being able to give real validity to these things. And the man was a live and visible creature there. And everybody else, you know, was just playing games. But if the man had been able to say, we are going to do these things, we will do these things, then it would have made considerable difference. So when you look at it from this point of view, from the prisoner's point of view, and see how few of those points were really substantive, and how lacking they were in valid political substance, valid promise, then it's not so strange that they were unwilling to accept all those points. I'd like to go now just for a moment or two to the question of the responsibility of the bloodshed at Attica. There were 42, I believe it's 43 lives by now have been lost at Attica. Now, on the one hand, by Monday morning when the attack went in, you have to talk about Attica in military terms, the assault, the attack, when it went in. By Monday morning when that happened, the prisoners had established 4 days, from Thursday to Monday, they established 4 days of credibility from the fact that the hostages would not be harmed. Late Sunday afternoon, I myself and seven other people who went in with, we all saw the hostages and we talked to them. We interviewed them, and some of those interviews were carried on national television. The hostages had not been harmed. That isn't remarkable. It was absolutely essential to the prisoner's cause in there that the hostages not be harmed. Once they began to hurt or kill or in any way to damage these hostages, why then their whole cause was lost. Obviously, they couldn't win on that basis. The one thing they had to do was to say, was to be able to use those hostages to win the points that they wanted. All right. So for 4 days, they'd been able to establish that credibility. The hostages might have been harmed nonetheless, despite all that. They might have been harmed in two situations, the first of which would be if something happened, an accident of some kind, something that caused panic to sweep the yard and result in riotous conditions. The hostages might have been harmed in those circumstances. That's a chance. Another chance is that the leaders of the revolt might have lost control, and the hostages could have been harmed. But everyone I've talked to, and the logic of the situation suggests that if they had lost control, the chances are at least 50-50 that they might have lost control not to extremists who wanted to murder people, but to those who were tired of the whole situation and frightened and wanted to surrender. It's at least 50-50 that they would have wanted to do that. So that the chances, in my judgment, that the hostages actually were going to be harmed by the prisoners were relatively slight. They existed to some extent, but they were relatively slight. Now, measure that against the absolute and unquestioned, in my judgment, certainty that an attack on the D yard was going to cause great loss of life. And that certainty derives from several factors, the first of which is that the prisoners themselves had convinced everybody that I know of, certainly everyone in the observers group, me, everyone that I can think of, they had convinced us all that if an attack came, they were going to kill the hostages. Now, there were 38 hostages. So if you figured them at only 50% effective, they're going to kill 19 hostages. So you can figure that to start with. Now, that's great loss of life. I think you would be correct in calling that a massacre if you had only that. The second thing is that you had only to be in Attica at that point for an hour or so, and this is one of the major reasons why a number of us wished for Governor Rockefeller to come there in person. You had only to be there for an hour or so to understand the fear and the anger and the frustration and the attitude that gripped the people who were going to carry out the assault, state troopers, sheriff's deputies, corrections officials, and so on. Try to picture these men. They're not bad men. They're not bad men at all. They're doing a particular kind of a job. They're mostly from upstate New York and small towns. They don't understand the urban realities of life. Very few of us understand the urban realities of life. Certainly they didn't. They're not well paid. They're not well educated. They're not men who are trained to the subtleties and sophistication of social conditions in America. They had been living there in the surrounding circumstance of the Attica prison for about 4 days. The weather was bad. It's kind of drizzly. Bad. They're being fed lousy ham sandwiches, and I know because I was eating them myself. It was about all they had. But they didn't know whether the prisoners had guns or not. They didn't know whether somebody in there might have had some dynamite or some other form of homemade explosive. Rumors were all over the place that Sam Melville, had wired it all up so that everybody was going to be electrocuted and all that kind of thing. So picture these guards then, not sophisticated men, irritated at their conditions, ripped out of their normal routine of things, not understanding the whole white-black problem that you had there and so forth, not sympathetic to prisoners and lawbreakers and, murderers and rapists and all that in the first place. Living in uncomfortable conditions, fearful for their own lives, not knowing what they're going to expect. And finally, put into that equation this fact, the fact that these men are incredibly, shockingly armed to the teeth. Now, this is one of the things that I've written 1,000 pieces, I guess, and that's an exaggeration. I've written 100 pieces in my time about gun control and all that. So, all right, 50. Ten. But you don't grasp the fact of the extreme and ultimate reliance of American society on sheer armaments until you see it, until you see these gigantic men all standing over 6 feet in jack boots up to here and with clubs the size of baseball bats, and with great revolvers strapped to their hips, and either carrying a shotgun or a rifle, and wearing enormous helmets and great goggles. Just really, really men from Mars who are almost unable to move. They're so buckled up into these damn things. And not only hundreds of men so armed and so accoutred in the prison there, but five and six blocks from the prison, at roadblocks in the, along the street here, where you, perfectly innocent people be stopped in their cars by five or six of these guys peering in there with guns pointed at people in cars. The reliance on guns, in this country is beyond belief. And having intellectualized that feeling many times before, to actually have seen it in action there is one of the most shocking things that ever happened to me. But anyway, when you've got men in the mental condition that I've so described, and when they've got the got this enormous variety of armaments, that they are, you can't issue that many guns to people without expecting that some of them are going to be used and so on, then that's a formula. That is literally a formula for a high number of deaths. And when you add to that, finally, the fact that you had 1,200 or 1,400 people, mostly black and Puerto Rican, cooped up in the space of about two football fields and surrounded by a high stone wall, a high brick wall, and you're going to have people, mostly white, coming in with all those guns, either over the wall or through the entrances, shooting, then it goes without saying, you don't have to be a weatherman to know which way the wind is blowing there. I mean, there's going to be a hell of a lot of people killed. You're going to have a massacre. And we try to say this. And so when you talk about the responsibility for bloodshed, you have, at Attica, you have to put the large possibility that having waited two or three more days up there, perhaps, would not have resulted in any additional deaths, might have resulted in some kind of a solution, some kind of a negotiated end of the whole thing. The large possibility on the one hand, against the absolute certainty on the other hand, that if you made an armed attack on that prison yard, you were going to have a great loss of life, not only among prisoners, but among the hostages. When you put that possibility against that certainty, you have to say to yourself, why didn't they wait a day or two more? What would have been so wrong about that? Why not wait and see if what's not negotiable on Sunday afternoon might not be negotiable on Tuesday morning? Why not wait? And I think the answer that you have to give to that, the answer that in any negotiating situation that I've ever heard about, and working on the New York Times, where we have 10 unions in our building, we know a good deal about negotiation. In any negotiating situation that I've ever heard about, the absolute, the basis of the whole thing is to keep the parties talking. Never let the thing get broken off into where one side is frozen into one position and the other side into another. Keep them talking. Well, why not have done that at Attica? And I think that the only reason you can give when you begin to look at it is because somehow the prisoners there were not really regarded as being persons with whom you could deal on a large basis. When I talked to Governor Rockefeller on Sunday afternoon, when others talked to him, or later in his written statement, he kept insisting that he, even if he had the authority to grant an amnesty, which he didn't believe he did, even if he had it, he wouldn't do it because he said that would undermine the basic tenets of our society. I'm inclined to think that 42 people are basic tenets of our society. And the question is, why doesn't the basic tenets of our society in some kind of abstract formulation, why is that not weighed against humanity here? Well, I think it's because prisoners aren't really considered, in this country, they aren't really considered as human beings. They aren't really thought of as people. Once they've committed that crime and they've been sent away, they've lost all their civil rights, they've lost all their due process rights. You've turned the key in the lock and thrown the key away, out of sight, out of mind. They're not considered as human beings. Yet the basic tenets of our society are very real to many people here. And I think that the fundamental problem in American life today is that we've forgotten humanity and favor of something that someone can call the basic tenets of our society. And you see the danger that leads to. If you think that somehow something that you can define as the basic tenets of our society, those things that we must maintain at all costs, those principles, those abstractions, those ideologies that we must maintain at all costs, whatever they might happen to be, if you tend to think that those things override the question of whether or not 42 people are going to lose their lives, or 28, or 15, or however many it might have been, or 100, I would have thought. If you tend to think that the basic tenets of our society override the lives of people, then you can easily begin to justify what has become the shocking record of American society for the use of official, sanctioned, legal violence as a solution to social problems in America. And I could call the roll here tonight from Jackson State through Orangeburg and Kent State and the Chicago Convention and Fred Hampton right on down to Attica to show you the extent to which American society has come to rely on the use of violence for the solution of social problems. And I submit to you that that could only result from a situation in which you begin to believe that some kind of abstract principles outweigh questions of humanity and questions of human life. So that's where I place the responsibility for bloodshed at Attica. A couple of other conclusions, the things that I came away from there that I'll try to put as briefly as I can. I'd like to raise the question of what we mean by prison reform. What is prison reform? I'm not at all sure after having been through this experience, but one conclusion that I carried away from Attica is that while we need it, and I'm certainly for it, that prison reform is not simply better and better administered custodial care of prisoners. I went through at one point up there, I went through the cell block C, which was not at that point in revolt. The guards were in charge there and everything was normal in that prison. And as we, in that cell block, and as we entered one of the tiers, as they call floors there, I've written about this, perhaps you saw it, but as you come into this long corridor, the cell on either side, and the big door opens that lets you into that corridor, sounded like the Inner Sanctum radio program, you know, you open that door. As you come in there, all of a sudden, and it's one of the most poignant and moving sights that I've ever seen in my life, and I can't convey it adequately, I wish I could. Out of each cell door, all the way down that corridor, on either side, there pops a shaving mirror. It comes out. The shaving mirrors come out almost as if they're automatic, almost as if they're key to the door. And the thing is, you see that the doors of the cells in cell block C there are solid sheets of steel, so that the prisoner lives in his cell with a solid sheet of steel, concrete on the floor, ceiling on the two sides, and a barred window. And in that solid sheet of steel is that's his door. There's an aperture about so big there's no use strain, you can't see that way. The only thing you can see is straight across the aisle to the aperture on the other side. Hence, if you want to see what's coming at you or what's gone past, you got to put your shaving mirror out. And it was one of the most moving experiences of my life to see those shaving mirrors come out automatically, because you think of men incarcerated there in such a way that they can't see what's coming to the left or what's going away to the right, or vice versa. And the thing that came to me there is that there's not really any way, with all the best intentions, we could bring in 1,000 Trappist monks for the guards, and we can do all kinds of things. We can carpet the floors, and there's no way that we can make cell block C a humane environment for people to live in. Because once you put a man in a cage, you have done the essential job. You've taken him out of humanity, and you've put him back into the ranks of quadrupeds, those people who are lower than what we refer to as human beings. When you put him in that cage, no matter what else you do, then you've made the essential decision that he no longer is a part of the human race, because people who have to live in cages by definition are animals, and they're not part of our society. And I think my conviction that there's no way to put men in cages and still give them a humane existence. Now, this raises the question in its sharpest form of what prison reform really is, because I'm willing to say, and I think my conviction is, that somewhere out there in the future, in an ideal situation, we shouldn't have these huge custodial institutions, these great tiers of cages where we put men in there to live within bars. That we shouldn't have that out at some point. I'll develop the reasons later. But in the meantime, we all know that we're going to have that for a good many years to come. And as Herman Schwartz said at a recent conference on this subject, it's all very well to talk about abolishing prisons out there in the future sometime. But what do you do about the prisoner who's been beaten up today? Do you go to him and say, don't worry, we're going to abolish prisons 20 years from now? Or what do you do? So you've got a question of short-run activity of trying to improve the administration of the prisons that we have, while at the same time, I think that you're trying to act out to the long pull where you rid yourself of the whole system of caging up men. Why do you do that? You rid yourself of the whole system of caging up men, it seems, first because it doesn't make any sense. Almost all the statistics and by every measure we have, we know that taking offenders against society and caging them up in this way and treating them as we do in these prisons, it doesn't make them wish they hadn't committed the offense and realize that they better not ever commit another offense or they'll be sent back to that. First place, it makes them angry. It makes them feel that they are the dregs of society. They've been deserted by society. They're scapegoats. They're less than human beings, which means they're angry and they won't strike back. It does that to them. It doesn't have any form of correctional effect on them, because in almost every custodial institution of that kind, the best that anybody does at job training is to teach them how to make automobile license plates or weave baskets, which is not exactly the way to make a living once you get out. It removes them from any form of responsibility for their own behavior. It delivers them almost without any form of appeal into the hands of other people who can make all kinds of administrative decisions without any form of due process or adversary proceeding or anything of the sort, just make decisions as to their whole future. And it's a formula, it seems to me, caging people up like that. It's a formula not for rehabilitation, so-called, or for reform, but for what, in one article or another, I referred to prisons once as universities of crime. That was before I knew anything about prisons. But to my amazement, it's one of the few cases where I've been proved right in my own judgment. They are universities of crime. You send people there, and they get graduate courses, and they come out, and they're worse than when they went in. And it raises the question, after the Gideon case, in which the state of Florida found out that it had imprisoned a number of men unconstitutionally, it had to turn all those men loose willy-nilly overnight. It turned all those prisoners loose, and it turned out that the recidivism rate among those men was very low, even though they were turned loose long before their sentences were completed. Now, that raises a question which some penologists ask. There's no way to get an answer to it, and politically it's impossible, but it raises this question. Suppose you open the doors of every prison tonight and turn loose every prisoner tonight. Would you get more or less crime from that group of men, 250,000 men approximately, state prisons and state and federal prisons, would you get more or less crime than if you required each and every one of them to serve out his term and then turn him loose? It's a real question, and no one knows, because but there's a strong supposition, you could make a strong supposition, that the conditions that prisoners endure in prisons would be likely to produce more crime than if you turn them loose now. Moreover, caging men up, public's always concerned with taxes and costs. Caging men up costs a hell of a lot of money for what you get out of it. I've just been out to California, and they've had a recent report on their correction system out there that's a massive detail, and it turns out that in California they spend $3,070 a year just for the custodial care of men in prisons. You don't get any rehabilitation or reform or anything out of that. That's just to take care of the guy. You spend for young offenders, in which they try to have a much better program and try to deal with him in some way so they won't be a repeat offender, he or she. That costs about $6,000 a year. I made the point in a recent column that if you cut the cost a little bit, you can send your daughter to Vassar for $5,000. But it costs $6,000 a year to deal with young offenders in a California prison. And yet, California gets the very best probation and parole services that it's capable of out there, and it's pretty good in that state. They've got a good correction system on the whole for about $600 a year per offender, one-fifth of what it costs to cage a man up. And the results are much better in the long run. But the net fiscal result, which ought to interest the taxpayers of California, the net fiscal result of that is that for the 53,000 people who are in prisons out there, or about 20% of the total offenders in the California system, California spent last year 67% of its total corrections budget, or about $147 million. On the other hand, for the 80% of all its offenders, who are on probation or parole, about 221,000 persons, California spent only $73 million, or 33%. Now that really is a perversion of the value of the dollar, of what you think you're doing here with your dollar. You're caging all those people up, and it's costing you a hell of a lot of money, and when they come out, the tendency generally is that they go right back into a life of crime, and yet that's where you're spending most money. And we seem to go on wanting to do this everywhere we go. In New York State, the Corrections Officers Union has just succeeded in arresting an agreement from the state at the point of threatening a slowdown in prison services. They've arrested an agreement for the state for the construction of a maximum security prison for the 500 odd people who are judged to be this year's worst prisoners. Now, when that fails, of course, they'll want a maximum security prison for the 300 odd who are even worse than the 500 odd there. This raises a lot of questions. In the first place, the construction of that prison would be enormously expensive. In the second place, would it do any good for those people? In the third place, and perhaps more important, who's going to pick the 500? The corrections officers obviously are going to pick them. And are the 500 really going to be the 500 most difficult, obstreperous, unreasonable, long-gone prisoners for whom nothing can be done? And there probably are 500 prisoners in the New York system that might meet that description. Or are they going to be the 500 guys who somehow want to assert their rights? They want to challenge prison administrative proceedings. They want to say, look, I'm a human being too. They want to give guards trouble in that sense. Which is it going to be? It could just as easily be, it seems to me, a penalty system for the corrections officers as it could be a place to really to get rid of the cases for whom nothing can be done. So the whole question of caging people up doesn't make any sense in terms of correcting their behavior, and it doesn't make any sense in terms of the cost to the state, and yet we seem to want to go on and do it. Now, the primary conclusion, past all these others that I brought away from Attica, probably reflects my instant expertise. It probably reflects the fact that I really don't know very much in any professional sense about all this, and perhaps I shouldn't have been shocked by these facts at all, and maybe I overrate their importance. But the primary conclusion that I brought away from Attica is that the public doesn't seem to understand that most of these men, at some point, and sooner rather than later, most of these men are coming out of our prisons, and they're coming back to live in Cambridge, and in New York, and elsewhere in Boston, and in Rochester, and in Buffalo, and in Washington, D.C., and Philadelphia. They're coming back to live among us, perhaps right down the block. The average prison term in this country for people who've been convicted of crimes and sent off to prison is 24 months. And it's a myth. And fostered from on high, I must say, this country. It's a myth that the way we treat prisoners here and the way to deal with crime is to put them away and turn the key in the lock and throw the key away. We don't do that. In this country. Now, maybe that's the kind of country we want. Maybe we need to dig a lot of dungeons deep into the earth and bury people there and forget about them. Maybe that's one way to deal with it. But the fact of the matter is, whether or not that's the way to deal with it, we don't do that. We have people who serve 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years in jail, and then they come out and they're back among us. Now, if that is the case, what do we want? What do we want about that? And that is the case at this time. Do we want, while those men are behind bars, do we want them to be physically abused? Do we want them to live in inhuman conditions? Do we want them to be, to equate brutal guards and unheeding administration with society in general? Do we want them to come to the conclusion that they are the forgotten men of American life, that they are being made the scapegoats of all the social ills of America, that having grown up in conditions that they had nothing to do with creating and being penalized for those conditions, now here they are in these inhuman dungeons? Do we want them feeling that way and then coming out 2, 3, 4, 5 years from the time they go in, coming out absolutely coiled up balls of hatred ready to strike back at society? Is that what we want? Or do we want somehow to create a system now, while we still have all these large custodial institutions that we have to deal with, do we want a system in which, at least in some rudimentary fashion, these men can believe that they're not totally forgotten by society, in which they retain certain legal and political rights, due process rights, for instance? Do you realize that whole long as your arm criminal record that is appended to the life of George Jackson, and for which I personally have been taken to task by Bill Buckley for not going into in enough detail, do you realize that most of that is an administrative record? That is to say that after Jackson had been sentenced for a crime, and which he may not have done, and went away to prison, most of Jackson's criminal record comes about from administrative decisions within the prison. Now, I wouldn't suggest for a moment that he didn't do all the things that were suggested, or some large part of them, but I would suggest that there's no way that we can know that he did, and that there's enough evidence in enough cases to suggest that sometimes those things are fabricated. That guards can fabricate incidents which even wardens can't check back upon. And that when wardens are confronted with situations where it's a prisoner against a guard, the warden is unlikely to rule in favor of the prisoner unless there's some objective evidence to suggest that kind of a decision, and there rarely is. So I'm trying to say that, do we want a system in which prisoners are thus deprived of any standing as human beings before any kind of a court or before any kind of administrative procedure? Or do we want a system in which the prisoners can retain some elementary consideration of themselves as human beings, as legal entities who have a right to a defense, to counsel, to due process? Do we want a system in which, horror of horrors, just think of it, perhaps a prisoner might be able to visit once a month with his wife overnight, which is one of the measures by which most of us judge whether or not we're human beings? Do we want that kind of a system? Do we want, for instance, one of the things proposed at Attica was that prisoners be paid the minimum wage? Terrible thing. Rapists paid the minimum wage. How can that even be suggested? But on the other hand, think how outraged society is at the number of people, the number of mothers with children who go on welfare. Now, a lot of those people who go on welfare are prisoners' families. Now, prisoners' families, if prisoners were paid the minimum wage, maybe their families wouldn't have to go on welfare. You can't say prisoners don't work. They're made to work. They're not lazy, shiftless bums. So if they're paid the minimum wage, maybe their families don't have to go on welfare. Moreover, maybe they even get a little nest egg for when they come out of prison. And because when they come out of prison, unless they're very lucky, it's going to take them a hell of a long time to find a job, because we don't hire ex-cons in this society if we can avoid it. Federal government doesn't do it. State government doesn't do it. If they could avoid it. So when these guys come out of prisons, they need a little something to tide them over, or else they're going to mug you or me tonight, because they've been taught that that's the way to survive. So I just raise the question of self-interest. What do we want here? Do we want a society that convinces these men, do we want a prison system that convinces these men that they are blobs of mud in the gutter, less than human beings? Or do we want a society, prison system that says to these men, you have offended us and we are going to exact a penalty, but nevertheless, you are still one of us, and we wish, if it's at all possible, to make you as willing to accept us as we are still willing to accept you in the way that we live. And I think at Attica, as a human response, one of the in addition to, as a Southerner, I said tonight, someone who'd asked me this, I'm a Southerner, I spent most of my life in the South, and I'm very keenly attuned to racial things and implications and so forth, you know, and I can pick all that up sort of at 60 yards through a gale with my background and these kind of things. And the prison yard there in Attica was the only place that I have ever been in all my life where there, as near as I could tell, there was no racism. And that raises some questions. You know, what do we got to do? Do we peel off layers of civilization until we get back to that point or not? I don't know. It's an interesting implication. But that's one thing that I carry away as a human and personal impression. But the thing that I carry away in the larger sense of a political impression is the repeated pleas, the repeated speeches, the rhetoric pounded home time and again by the leaders of the revolt, by odd people who would come up out of the crowd and seize the microphones and talk. the repeated refrain, we are not statistics, we are not numbers, we are men, we are human beings, and we want to be treated as human beings. And it seems to me that this is the key to prison reform. The key to prison reform is somehow we've got to learn to treat these people as human beings. And I raise the question whether out there, ultimately, finally, you can treat people as human beings if you incarcerate them in cages. One final little anecdote here on, as we were getting ready to go in on Sunday, the last trip into the prison yard that several of us took, there was a question that arisen. I won't go into detail as to people's good faith and so forth and so on. And Assistant Corrections Commissioner Dunbar of New York said with some heat and some passion, and he obviously felt what he was saying, through the iron bars to Richard Clark, known to us as Brother Richard, who was one of the leaders of the revolt. He said to Brother Richard, he said, in 30 years of corrections work, I've never lied to an inmate. And Brother Richard said to him with, I thought, sort of icy chill and ultimate meaning in his voice, he said, but what about to a human being? Have you ever lied to a human being? And the difference between inmates and human beings is what we're talking about here. And it seems to me it's a very vital and important difference, and that is going to be ultimately the key to the whole question of prison reform. And I think that this ought to be among the vast numbers of the problems that we face in American society. This ought to be among the most manageable. Now, maybe I'm wrong about that, but it seems to me that we know who the prisoners are, and we know how many they are, and we know where they are, and we know what the institutions are, and I suspect most professional penologists and corrections officers could sit down and make you a list of the prisons in America from good to worst. And it would, and all the lists would come out pretty close, I expect. So we know about all these things. It's a manageable problem. If we wanted to do away with all those institutions and build other institutions, halfway houses, whatever they might be, in their stead, it would be a manageable problem financially. I don't mean to say it would be cheap, but it could be done. It's not like the defense budget. It doesn't repeat every year, and it could be done fairly often. Fairly easily. There's a clear public interest, in other words, in the cost. From that point of view, there's a clear public interest in the cost because we know that probationary and parole services cost less than custodial services. There's a clear public interest because we know, insofar as we know anything about this field, that kind of service, probationary and parole services, are more effective than custodial services. And there's a clear moral purpose in all this, it seems to me, because obviously if we can deal with these people in an open situation in their own communities where the offense occurred, that is a more humane situation than by shipping them off out of sight, out of mind, turning the key and throwing away the lock, as we think, in places like Attica or Folsom or San Quentin or wherever it might be. And it seems to me that given all those circumstances, that this is both in a quantifiable sense, it's a manageable problem, not beyond the capacity of people to deal with. And in a political and a moral sense, it's a problem in which we have clear reason to do this. We have clear self-interest, which ought not to be beyond the capacity of the hardest hat to perceive. So we've got clear self-interest, and we've got manageability in quantifiable terms. And I suggest to you that when you look at the array of problems we face in this country, from the decaying cities, racial problems, our educational situation, so many of these problems are vast and amorphous and indefinable by comparison to prison reform. If the great American people in what I'm convinced is their ultimate generosity and their ultimate genius, if the great American people can't deal with the question of prison reform, then I don't think we're going to be able to deal with any of these other problems. Thank you very much.